Okay, this is the very first podcast from badquaker.com. Our podcast number 001. We'll name it 001. That way we have hundreds to go before we fill them all up. Today is April 20th. That's 420. And we're going to talk about 420 and maybe the significance of that. But before we get to that, we've got a couple other things to cover. I'm Ben Stone. I'm here with Kai. And you probably have read her stuff on badquaker.com as Coyote. But here on a casual basis, we're just going with Kai. And I'm Ben. And we don't do like Mr. or Mrs. or this or that. Kai's my daughter anyway, so we wouldn't be referring to each other that way. But we don't do that kind of nonsense because we're bad Quakers and we don't call people Mr. and Mrs. and Your Highness and other things like that. Butts are not made to be kissed. Okay, now, enough of that. We've got a couple topics we want to cover. One of the things that we want to look at, we had recently a totally pirated, unauthorized posting on our website of the book Bourbon for Breakfast by Jeffrey Tucker. And he did an article on the movie Beowulf. And so we stole that completely without his permission and posted it, which he actually did appreciate because all us crazy anarchists don't believe in intellectual property rights. That's a made-up thing by the government. So before we get to the topic of 420, we're going to touch on Beowulf. Both Kai and I saw the movie. It's been some time since I saw it. But keeping in mind Jeffrey Tucker's article on it, we're going to talk about that article and our opinions about the movie and the original story. So, Kai, what do you think about the Jeffrey's article?
Well, I had a couple of disagreements with it. Right off the bat, I have a disagreement with him saying that the visuals were good. I thought the visuals were spectacularly bad. But, you know, that aside, the actual substance of the film, he makes reference to it being an attack on government and leadership, and I don't think it is. I think my cynicism has a tendency to say that Hollywood is less likely to attack the state than they are to attack anarchy. And I actually think that Beowulf, now it's been a decade since I've actually read the original, or not the original, but the story itself.
The English version.
Right. So, you know, details are fuzzed out. But the general overview of the story is that you have a community, and the community has a leader, and they have this monster that's coming to attack them. And the leader, instead of drafting the young men of the town as a military, instead of stealing the gold from the town to pay for a hero, the community as a whole decides that they need to purchase the services of this hero. And so they do so, and the hero goes and defeats the monster, and they reward him by promoting him to eldership of the community and providing him with a good life. And I think that that is a very anarcho-capitalistic thing.
Rothbard would be perfectly comfortable with that.
Absolutely. And it, so to me, that's not a statist ideal. That is an anarcho-capitalistic ideal.
Well, that would also go exactly in line with what the Germanic and Celtic and those Northern European tribes were fully accustomed to seeing and understanding. That's how their systems functioned.
Mm-hmm.
There was no state for thousands of years in Northern Europe. And so they had this story that outlined exactly how they would have handled such a situation had one occurred.
And so you take this perfectly anarcho-capitalistic story, and then Hollywood kind of gets its talons into it, and it takes it from a really honorable, mercenary-based story plotline And they twist it around into, you know, clearly the mercenary is, you know, bad and easily...
corrupted.
Yeah, corrupted. So I don't see it as being an attack on the state, because I don't view that the original story was a statist story. I think it's an attack on elder leadership in a community and hired mercenaries.
I kind of have the opinion, pretty much any time Hollywood puts their hands on anything, you know, I could whip out 20 different movies that were made about biblical stories, or you could take Homer's adaptations that Hollywood has done to Homer's stories. And you look at a story, whether it's true or not is not the point. You know, you take the Moses story that was made in the movie Ten Commandments, you take the different variations of the Trojan story, and without even arguing whether these original stories are true or whether we have a word-by-word actual account of them is not the point. The point is, this story has successfully existed for thousands of years, and then some Hollywood writer gets his hands on it and decides he can improve it by making it look like every other Hollywood movie.
Yep.
So in the Moses situation, this fantastic movie that got all kinds of awards and is so such a standard of Hollywood, the movie Ten Commandments, has the basic Hollywood storyline of the hero and the heroine and the villain and it's all exactly, it could be any other Hollywood story. It could,
yep.
You know, and then we go to Beowulf, and you have this wonderful story that's lasted thousands of years. We don't even know its source. It's older than writing itself in Northern Europe, and Hollywood can fix it. And that alone, it just burns me.
But reeks of egotism.
It really does. And that, well, Hollywood's the home of egotism. If there's any, if there's a world capital of egotism, it's Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But that biased me against the movie to begin with. And so I think in watching the movie, even after that, having that as the situation, I just went into it expecting it not to be good and expecting not to like it. And then it became basically a showplace for Angelina Jolie and where I just never really picture an evil dragon in that way.
There's some other issues with their retelling of the story also, because you have this situation where instead of it being a heroic person attacking an evil monster, you have what amounts to a disabled child that is just kind of not knowing any better, doing things that a disabled child would do, and you have this bully coming in and attacking it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that brings in this whole level of feeling sympathy towards the monster and, again, attacking a mercenary figure and making him not a hero anymore.
Considering that a lot of anarchists actually view the state in a dragon-like form, it's not hard to look at the dragon in Beowulf and imagine that the story actually was talking about a state attempting to take over. If you go through the different versions of theology around the world, very oftentimes the state is a dragon. And in things that I write, I constantly refer to the state as a dragon, because no other entity within our mythology or within any writing or anything like that fits the description of a state better than a dragon. So for an entire culture that's lived without the state for thousands of years, as Northern Europe did, having the dragon as an intricate part of their mythology, that the dragon lives in a faraway place, the dragon hoards gold, other people's gold, gold that it takes great pleasure in stealing and then squatting on and just sleeping on it and just holding it and hoarding it to itself. The dragon swoops in out of nowhere when it's unexpected, goes in, basically robs a town, burns and kills randomly without any real patterns or anything like that. Will regularly tax. There are dragon stories where the dragon actually taxes the town, mm-hmm. and yep. the town brings a tax to keep the dragon from attacking. And so, in every way, to me, the dragon is just the perfect example of a non-statist society viewing a state. And Northern Europe was constantly at risk of having a state attack them, whether that state was the Persians or later the Greeks and then the Romans. And there were constantly large states that were nearby who would have just loved to feed off of the wealth of Northern Europe.
And it was an issue where you couldn't go kill the mother dragon, mm-hmm. you know, because it's off in...
Untouchable.
Its own little state, and you can't deal with it. All you can deal with are the
little wannabe states that want to crop up and come and
yeah,
bother
the,
you.
Yeah, the fingers that come out and attack, you know. You can deal with the army that's marching in trying to control you, but you can't go attack the country that it's coming from.
Right. You can't get to that source. I like the way Tolkien refers to dragons as worms. I think that's just really cool. Mm-hmm. And I know that Tolkien never took political stance and he didn't say a whole lot, but there's so much anarchy, anarcho-capitalism specifically, that is whether intentional or otherwise, it's an undertone of so much of Tolkien's stuff. And then to see the way he describes dragons and actually refers to some of them as worms, and has them like crawling along on the ground on their belly, you know, that just, I get a thrill out of reading that. That's, you know, of course, that's going back into the parts of Tolkien that are not going to get movies made out of them.
Which is sad, because those are the parts of Tolkien that movies could actually be made out of.
Yeah, you could really make dozens of movies out of that.
And they would be movies that, you know, 2 hours long.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to chop big sections of them out. It doesn't have to be a huge epic.
Yeah. Well, so we butchered Jeffrey Tucker's thing that I love to read so much. I love to read Jeffrey Tucker's stuff, and I really enjoyed reading his critique of the movie Beowulf. I just didn't necessarily agree with it. Now, on the rare occasion that Jeffrey Tucker may, like this could happen, that Jeffrey Tucker may hear this recording, he is liable to think that I posted his critique just so we could rip him apart. And that's not at all the case. I really like Jeffrey Tucker's writing, and I fully enjoyed reading his opinion of Beowulf. And, you know, that's the wonderful thing about having a writer that you really enjoy, is that you don't have to always agree with them. You can still read their stuff and fully enjoy it, and just go, well, that's great. I don't agree, but that's great. You know?
And the other thing is, I had watched Beowulf, and I was kind of meh about it, mm-hmm. but I had never thought about it in terms of anarcho-capitalism, the state, anything like that. It was just a movie.
Yeah.
And then to read his review and to kind of have to come up with, you know, what my thoughts on the subject were, you know, it makes you think. It makes you reevaluate what it is your position is.
Well, so Tucker's efforts then are not lost, even if you disagree. It caused you to think,
mm-hmm.
and that's real. You know, I'm reminded of this just because I was listening to a audio version of a Hayek thing earlier today, and so often I'm struggle with Hayek. I just have such a hard time either understanding what he's saying or really being comfortable in what I'm reading to think, I can read Rothbard and it's like, yes, this is what I've always thought. There was never a time when I didn't think this. I just never put it together like this. Or, you know, I read Rothbard and it just goes right to my soul, and it's like, it's almost like I'm saying it. Right. You know? But I read Hayek, and it's like, what are you talking about?
Why can't you speak in English?
Yeah. Well, he's not English. But but this thing today, this audio portion that I got off of Mises.com today, was the first time that I was listening to Hayek, and it was like, yeah, go Hayek! But even at that, even when I don't fully understand Hayek or don't agree with him, it's still very stimulating to read his stuff, just like what I was saying with Tucker there, that you can read it, and even if you don't fully agree or even if you don't fully accept it, it gets your brain cells bouncing around in there, and at least, you know, some blood flow flowing. It's 420.
It is.
It is April 20th, and that is the fourth month and the 20th day, and that means something to some people. There are people who make a big deal about the numbers 420, and it's mostly because a very small little pocket of Puritanistic twisted minds have decided that they're going to enforce upon everyone else their moralities and their beliefs.
Because we all know prohibition works so well.
Yeah, yeah. Black markets never pop up. There's never any downside to having an outlawed substance, right? And once you just pass a law, then that thing disappears altogether. You never Absolutely. Have to deal with it again.
The other thing that 420, I think, brings about is an issue that... It's a states' right issue. We have several different states here in the United States that have legalized to one degree or another certain substances. And yet, even in that state, if you are legally imbibing that substance, you can be kidnapped by federal goons and put into a cage for imbibing a totally legal substance in that state.
And it's not only just that it's legal in that state. We're talking about things that have been an intricate part of the human experience for thousands of years. We're talking about totally natural substances that go back literally to caveman days. That archaeology's oldest records indicate that it was right there with us the whole time. And yet now, all of a sudden, in the last few years, a small group of little people, and I don't mean that in little in height as far as how many inches and feet they are tall, little as far as their brains and little as far as their egos to think that they have to lord upon other people and tell other people how to act. They decide we can't have these things. They decide that these things are bad.
And we can't be trusted.
Yeah. Our decisions are not good enough. We have to depend on their decisions.
Yeah. And it doesn't matter that this has been not only communally used, but medicinally used as well.
Absolutely.
It has been proven time and time again to cure a whole variety of illnesses, and it is medicinally safe, and yet it's not being approved for usage.
Now, you and I have talked about this before. There's a word that is common to languages that is oftentimes one of the first words that a baby will learn when it's very first being nurtured. And this word is one of the words that is used to tie the English and the Germanic languages back to some of the ancient languages that come from southwestern Europe in the
Cockle Mountains up there.
Yeah, and tying English and Germanic languages back to the Sanskrit and some of the other languages that Hindi comes out of. And you know the word that I'm talking about.
I do. And it's very interesting that we would be restricting something that's so basic to human life.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously, if you've followed us along this far, you know that we're clearly talking about raw milk.
Milk, sure. What else would we be talking about?
And it's actually, it's a growing problem here in this country. We have people who are being put in federal prisons because they are selling raw milk legally.
I can imagine a situation where there's a guy sitting there. Now, I'm a biker. I've ridden. I have a Harley sitting in the garage. I've had motorcycle. I've been around motorcycles all my life. My dad, and my uncle, his brother, used to get on their bikes. One rode a Harley. My dad rode a Harley. His brother, my uncle, rode an Indian. They would get on their bikes. This was right after World War II in Dayton, Ohio, and they would ride back to their home in eastern Kentucky. And then they would ride back to Dayton, Ohio, where they worked in factories. And my brother rode a motorcycle all the time I was growing up. So I'm coming from a biker point of view here, so don't think I'm being derogatory for anybody. But I want to create a picture in your mind. You got some guys sitting around, and there's a gentleman there who's obviously a gang member. He's let's imagine he's of Hispanic descent. He's got the tattoos on his arms indicating what gangs that he's a member of. There's another gentleman there. He's clearly of Asian descent, and he clearly, by his tattoos, he belongs to an Asian gang. There's a biker there, and by his tattoos and by his general appearance, you can tell what biker gangs he belongs to. There's, let's say, let's get really nasty, there's a white supremacist there, and he's with his shaved head, and he's got a giant swastika tattooed on the top of his head.
And all of these gang members are funded by illegal substances.
Every one we mentioned. And in walks an Amish man, and he takes off his hat, and he adjusts his suspenders, and he sits down, and the biker looks at him and says, "What are you in for?" "Dealing." "Yeah." "Manufacture." "Yeah."
"And
distribution." "Yep."
"Crossing state lines."
"Crossing a state line." "Yep." "How did they catch you?" "They raided us." "They raided us with what?" "With a guy? With just a sheriff? With maybe a warrant?" No. "No, SWAT team. A SWAT team has to go out to the Amish farm. A whole SWAT team has to go to the Amish farm and grab this peaceful man.
And arrest him and put him in a cage for selling something that is naturally occurring and that poses no problem. It poses no health issues. And yet, we are being told by our government handlers that it is in our best interest that we do not consume this.
Let me go off on... I already went on one rant right there, but let me go off on a slightly different rant. It's often brought up, but raw milk can carry different illnesses and diseases. You can have bacteria, you can have this and that. And all those things are true, but so can pretty much any other food that's raw, whether we're talking about hamburger, spinach, or anything else.
In fact, the majority of E. coli cases that have happened in the last decade have actually come from leafy green vegetables, spinach, lettuces, things of that nature.
Well, you know what the answer is there.
Clearly, you can't be allowed raw spinach.
Not only that, a lot of spinach comes to the United States from Mexico, so I'm pretty sure what we need to do is bomb Mexico.
Right.
I mean, that works everywhere else, right?
Absolutely.
Perhaps we should go in and take over Mexico and let the CIA run the spinach business. That worked out great in Afghanistan and Cambodia prior to that.
Absolutely.
A lot of people misunderstand this situation with milk because they don't know the history of how specific types of milk became illegal. They don't understand that in the big cities in the 1800s and early 1900s, that local politicians working with ethnic crime organizations actually ran the farmers out of business and wouldn't let the farmers come into town and openly sell their milk products. And the crime organizations took over the milk distribution in many of our major cities. And when a farmer comes into town with a wagon and jugs of milk, if he has milk that he can't sell over the course of the day, he takes it back and feeds it to his pigs. But when a crime organization takes a wagon full of milk and they go through a town, a city, and they don't sell all of their milk, Then they just show up to a restaurant and they say, now you're going to buy an extra 20 gallons of milk. And the restaurant does it because they don't have a choice. They prefer not to have their restaurant burned down. And when the restaurant owner goes to a politician and says, hey, they're making me buy too much milk, then the politician goes to the crime guy and says, hey, give me a cut of the milk money. And the problem is solved, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And yet we're having spoiled milk sold at the restaurant. Now, what do we need to do? We clearly need a law, right?
Exactly.
We need to punish the farmer, the stinking farmer. How dare that stinking farmer supply bad milk?
Yep. And the other thing that comes about is that we have these large, unsustainable factory farms that are run by corporations deep in the pocket of the state. And so they don't feed their cows things that make healthy milk. They feed their cows things like soy and corn and ground up chicken. And these are things that produce milk that is not good. It's not, it doesn't have the proper vitamins. It doesn't have, it's really awful milk. It's full of hormones.
And this happens strictly because of the regulation, because the government came into the milk industry and began over-regulating it and began to allow one company to have a monopoly over a certain area, a district. If the funny thing is, if you go to, we're in southwestern Ohio. If you go to, let's say, a Kroger store in southwestern Ohio, and you check the milk brands that are there, and then you go to the IGA, and you check the milk brands, and you go to the five or six other stores, and you check the milk brands, you see an odd coincidence. It's all the same milk.
Yep.
Maybe there's two, maybe there's three authorized dairies in the area. But all the milk, basically, is distributed and controlled, and all the prices are fixed. It's an entirely fascist process.
Yep. And not only that, but that removes from the process accountability.
Exactly.
If I buy my milk from Farmer Brown down the street, and that milk makes me sick, I go to Farmer Brown, and I tell him this, and
exactly.
He either makes it right, or I don't buy my milk from Farmer Brown anymore.
Right.
But I can't do that with, you know, Dean's.
Mm-hmm.
If Dean's milk makes me sick, I can sue them. But they'll just pay me, and it doesn't affect them any.
Right.
And because the USDA allows for no competition amongst its regulatory commissions.
You can't have a private. This is a lot of people don't realize. There's a thing called the, what is it called? They inspect electrical devices, and they authorize they have a stamp that goes on electrical devices that say that this is a safe electrical device. I can't remember the name of it, but it'll pop in my head as soon as we turn the recording off. Anyway, they are an independent laboratory.
Good Housekeeping does this.
Good Housekeeping does it. Consumer Magazine, Consumer Reports Magazine. United Laboratories.
It's UC, isn't it?
UL. United Laboratories. Something like that. Anyway, beside the point. They're an independent review, and they were required in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when all kinds of electrical devices were being made, and not all of them were safe. As a matter of fact, many of them weren't safe. You could plug in a fan in those days, and it just had open blades with no shroud around it or anything like that. Very dangerous thing. And
of course, you knew at the time not to stick your face up next to it.
Or you'd learn. You know, it was a learning process. But companies like this, independently analyzing products, would give things a rating. And if they failed in that rating, or if they passed that rating, then the consumer would know that.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have now with the FDA is the FDA doesn't even allow an independent organization to do an independent audit, And an independent authorization or an independent...
With the exception of the kosher industry, that's the only way that an independent source can actually evaluate whether your food is up to a certain specific standard or not, is the kosher regulations. Other than that, you have no way of knowing.
But we're supposed to trust that the government protects us.
You know, and we're supposed to trust that the USDA is going to actually be effective and regulate to a standard that the big agricultural businesses didn't actually pay to make the standard.
Oh, you think they'd do that? You think a big company like Archer Daniels Midland or Monsanto or...
Oh, Monsanto.
You think one of those companies would actually go to a congressman or a group of congressmen and actually ask for a law to be written? Or maybe even present a law and say, hey, what if you guys pass this law? And then they all go on a cruise ship and they have... They get all kinds of perks. And the next thing you know, that law is passed. I can't imagine that kind of a thing happening.
No, surely not.
Because if it could happen in something like the, you know, the food industries or in farming, it could happen in pretty much any industry, like maybe, light bulbs. That'd be crazy. Like if a company like GE could invest millions of dollars into getting a law passed that outlaws all light bulbs except the one they own the patent on. That'd be crazy, wouldn't it?
And specifically outlawing the light bulbs that they just had the patent run out on.
Yeah. Well, we don't hold the patent on the incandescent bulb anymore. Let's just get a law passed so that everybody has to buy these new twisty, ugly bulbs from us at, what, 9 times the price?
Which is interesting. I would be interested in seeing how long they had actually been holding on to those stupid complex fluorescent bulbs and just been waiting until that patent ran out so that they could introduce it.
Or until the exact right combination of Congress were there so that they could drop it on us. Yeah.
And that's the thing with capitalism. Let's take a look at the candle versus the incandescent light bulb. There didn't need to be a law outlawing candles. There didn't need to be a law saying that you had to switch over to incandescent light bulbs. The general public went, you know what? I think that's a better product. It produces more light. It doesn't catch my house on fire. It's a better product. I'm going to buy it.
And, you know, even on the light, pretty much everybody knows that the light was invented by the
Edison.
Guy. Edison, yeah, that's him. Edison invented the light bulb, or at least his team invented the light bulb. But most people don't realize that the light bulb had been toyed with for a generation prior to that, and they just couldn't come up with the right combination of materials for the filament that would last a period of time that would make it economical to produce and buy and sell. So technically, the light bulb existed prior to Edison inventing it, so to speak. But the market demanded that a better light bulb be available. And that's why Edison was motivated. That market demand, an entirely invisible market demand, was there and motivated Edison and his team to put, here's a thought. I wonder how much government money went into the development of the light bulb. Oh, none! None.
But didn't it take a war to stimulate that kind of growth? I mean, all the best inventions come from war, don't you know?
That's what we're told. Yeah. We'll have to do another one of these sometime, specifically on the aircraft industry, because that's one that I love to talk about, how the government has not helped the aircraft industry through its war, but how it's entirely held down the aircraft industry and perverted it. Or space. We should do one on space, because I love to talk about how the government held down all development in space. Or, you know, computers would be an easy, that's low fruit. That's you know, that's just walking by the apple tree and picking one off. Computers, you know, 1930s, oh, look, we have a computer. Oh, well, now it belongs to the government, and the only thing it's good for is for making a naval ship to be able to fire on target. Yeah, but we could use these for business. Nope, naval ship. That's it.
Yep, and it took a group of criminals in garages
tinkering. Stinking hackers.
To actually get it to where it was usable.
The hackers are as bad as the farmers.
Absolutely. You gotta lock them right up. Back on the raw milk, just for one quick second, I did want to point out that the third annual Raw Milk Symposium is May 7th in Bloomington, Minnesota. And you can find more information about that from farmtoconsumer.com. And it is being held by the Weston A. Price Foundation. So,
yeah, you're always at it with the Weston A. Price thing.
Yeah, I like him. I can't help it.
Cult members.
You know, you got to get your Activator X in.
Okay, so we were going to hit on a couple other things. We're going to maybe pick on Trump, and I was going to throw in a thing about the birthers.
Talking about low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, but I think we'll probably wrap it up. That was pretty good for our first time. And hopefully that will be the first of many podcasts here from badquaker.com. And thank you very much for listening. Bye.